Hello, everyone, and welcome into Debate Night yet again. I'm Hunter, joined as always by Brody in Dallas remotely, and then Silas is in studio today. It's the off season, which means there's not a ton going on in the disc golf world to talk about, but we still got stuff to go over. We still got stuff to go through. Black Friday's coming up, pretty exciting times at Foundation. A lot of sales, drops, all kinds of stuff happening. You can check all our social media for the specifics, but four different type of mystery boxes, 15% off all weekend long from 6 to 7 p.m. on Friday, 25% off site-wide, some black-on-black apparel, all kinds of good stuff going down. So you're not going to miss out on any of that. But Brody, how's your off-season going so far?
Oh, it's going. I was going to say, I saw your guys' new black-on-black stuff that you were wearing in Grip Locked. That was pretty sick.
Yeah. I really like the line. I'm actually rocking the hat today.
The black-on-black hat.
Black on black. You can barely see the Foundation logo, but in person when the light hits it, it's pretty sick.
It's pretty nasty. Okay. Sick. No, off season's been going really good. Haven't been playing too much disc golf, mainly because of the weather. It's been either rainy or cold and windy, which is fine because my focus right now really I'm gonna try to get something set up here. Maybe in the garage or something. I don't have as much space in this house as I did in Lynchburg or I did in my previous house in Dallas as far as like indoor stuff goes. So
for like putting and stuff?
Yeah. So I'm going to try to maybe get something set up, a net or I don't know. It seems like the garage maybe can only get like 25 footers in, which is obviously better than nothing, but the setup here is not as ideal as I would have liked it to be, but for me, the off season importance really is like trying to get back into shape because I think that's
something. I was gonna say you've been tweeting about your weight loss journey, and then I just saw your bike. I'm assuming you're tracking that on Peloton, but biking from Dallas to New York. Yeah, is that a little bit more than you anticipated?
Well, it's like a third. It's a third party app, right? So. I'm doing Power Zone training. And for those that don't know what that is, you essentially take this test. It's 20 minutes long. And essentially, after taking this 20-minute test, it essentially gauges what your fitness level is at that moment. And then it basically creates seven zones for you of how much effort, or in this case, output that you're producing. So output is produced by cadence and resistance. So if you have a low resistance, high cadence, you're going to have a certain output. If you have a high resistance, low cadence, you're going to have the same output. But you basically, the way they have these Power Zone classes set up is me and Hunter could be taking the same exact class. And even though Hunter at the end does like 700 output and I do 500 output, our bodies are going to be feeling exactly the same because it's exactly what we needed for our fitness level.
It's based on like personal exertion.
Yeah. So after a couple weeks of taking these classes and doing more and getting more back into shape, I'll retake the test, get new levels basically, and then continue taking more classes and building. So the thing at Peloton that's kind of tough right now is back when I was taking classes and I was in a lot better shape, all those scores or, class scores, whatever you want to say, like I can see what my output used to be in classes.
Yeah.
So I'm like 15 minutes in a 45 minute workout and my output is 180 and I can see what my output was when like my best ride and it's like 375. And I'm like, oh my God, like I'm so far back. So that's just like the journey thing I posted. That is just a like third party app where you can just decide where you want to go. You can pick where you want to start and you can pick where you want to go anywhere in the world. And it's just a fun little thing that it just adds on all the miles you do in your workouts. So some people are like asking, which would actually be pretty sick. Like, are you physically taking that trip? Like, so if you get to a bridge, GPS wise, does your Peloton like increase resistance to like make up for that hill? And it's like, no, that would have been kind of cool. It's more just over the course of these several months of me riding, I'm just going to see how far I can get close to New York. So we'll see.
Makes sense.
But yeah, no, those are going good. The rides are going good. I'm getting in some walks too on the treadmill, like at an incline. So like to kind of simulate what it would be like to walk on a disc golf course, kind of just get some of that in when I'm not out playing. And then getting back into the gym as well. Got a good lifting program that I'm doing, strength and conditioning program. And yeah, I think I'm down already a few percentage points in body fat, which is great. And I'm hoping to be down like 6 pounds, I would say, 6 or 7 pounds by next Monday. Mm. So we'll see. When you're super, super fat, the weight comes off very quickly. And then obviously it slowly starts coming off the more you get down. But so far I'm very happy with everything. And the way I view it is, you know, last year I felt very explosive at the beginning of the season. And cause I was obviously in shape at that time. And I think what happened is like I was very explosive, but maybe my form, maybe things weren't all lined up perfectly in the beginning of the season. And as the season went, my throwing and everything got better, but my fitness got worse. And so I didn't really see this drastic change in performance. If anything, my performance was better towards the end of the season. But my question is like, it can't hurt to like maintain that fitness throughout the season. So yeah. I'm not going to get worse by being more explosive, be stronger, more fit at the end of the season. So my whole thing is like, it can't hurt to help to just try to get back into a really good shape and then like maintain that throughout the season. So we'll see. We'll see what ends up happening.
Is there anything you're like focusing on specifically like in the gym? Cause like, obviously it sounds like Peloton and walking, that's a lot of cardio and leg stuff, but gym wise, like lifting, is there any like thing specific you're focusing on or like muscle groups that you've realized like this is what I need to target disc golf wise? Cause I've always been fascinated by that. Like I've heard some people do like tennis or baseball, like training exercises and stuff, but like while they're close, obviously they're not exact. So I didn't know if there's anything like you're like, oh, I really found when I do X, Y, or Z that really helps my game or anything like that.
Yeah, for me right now, it's just kind of a full body thing. No, not right now, bud. Sorry. The dogs are dogs are whining. Right now, it's just a full body thing. So right now, the focus is more on just getting back to a decent level of fitness. Because right now, if you saw me in some of these gym workouts, you'd be like, what the heck, dude? It's not good. So try to get back to a decent – can you stop right now? Go to mom. Go to mom. Go to mom. Go to mom. Thank you. Try to get to a decent level of fitness. And then once I get there, I can start focusing on some movements and stuff like that. Like a lot of the footwork, like to me, I thought that helped a lot doing a lot of ladder work. So,
okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. Busting out and just being more light on your toes, light on your feet, if you will. And just have better footwork. I think that helps. Obviously, the flexibility, I think, is a huge one too when it comes to injury prevention, but also, you know, just being able to get into certain positions, scrambling and whatnot. But all those will come more when I actually get to a decent level of fitness. It's kind of the same thing as like if you take someone to the gym, you're not going to have them do too much strenuous stuff right away because their body's just going to get wrecked and it's going to be harder for them to want to keep coming back. So like the whole idea is to like slowly kind of work yourself into it so you don't overload too quick. But
yeah,
I'm already in week 3 we're ramping it up already on just the actual like volume, I guess you could say. Eventually what I'll do is I'll have like a specific workout session that is more focused on like disc golf. So the gym will always be just getting strength, getting explosion, all that stuff. And then the secondary workout will be more about movement, flexibility, quickness, those type of things, Yeah, that's basically it.
That makes sense. Are you doing this all yourself, or you have like a trainer?
So for the cardio stuff, Peloton, you have, you know, obviously the people that are taking the class, doing the classes and whatnot.
Yeah.
And you can have, you can basically take, they have stuff on there for you, but again, I use this like third party, it's called Power Zone Pack. I've been doing rides and stuff with them for years. And I think they have a good system of picking classes that work. So I do that for my cardio side of things. And then the strength and conditioning side, I do have a personal trainer for that. And then all the other movement and stuff like that, I have a guy for that as well that I've been working with for, you know, Ultimate and all that for the past year. So
makes sense. Well, cool. I've always been fascinated with that when off season comes around, how people take are different
do and stuff.
Yeah, they take different approaches to different focuses on stuff. So
yeah, I mean, I'll say this too. I don't think disc golf it is as critical, right?
Like, no.
If I was in my fitness level that I was at the end of the season, Ultimate, I would be getting laughed off the field. You can't be in bad shape and play Ultimate. Yeah. But in disc golf, you know, you can get away with it very easily. But again, I just don't think it can hurt.
Well, it's similar to golf in a lot of ways, right? Like,
yes,
you can have like a John Daly, but like, obviously there's a reason that all these guys are spending so much time and energy and everything in the gym getting their fitness level up, because like, whether it's just flexibility and disc golf flexibility, I think is huge. Just the explosiveness of being able to just the movement in disc golf is very explosive, but it also can be done in a non-athletic way, if that makes sense, to where you don't have to have like, you can be unflexible and still play disc golf at a decent level. Mm-hmm. But I think that to be able to maintain that throughout a season and throughout a tournament consistently is where the like fitness level comes in, if that makes sense. I don't know what I just said, but it made sense in my head.
No, yeah. It's something that's not dire, but
yeah,
it's something that you can also get by with just playing disc golf, right? Because obviously if you don't do anything, if you have a very sedentary lifestyle and you just start adding disc golf into that lifestyle, you're going to start losing weight. If you don't do anything different, if you don't change your eating or anything like that, if you don't do anything, you start doing something, you're going to lose weight pretty easily. So I think that it's the same way of like, if you're just constantly playing disc golf, you're going to get stronger in the movements that you're doing for disc golf. So there is that, but could you be getting stronger faster doing other stuff? Yes. The question is like, how big of a gap does that make? And I guess the answer will be found out this year coming up. So, I haven't had a season where I've been healthy and strong and fit. So I'm looking forward to having one next year and seeing what happens. But speaking on social media, because I know we were talking a little bit about it, first got to say, what the heck happened to Argentina? Those people watching now, do you know what happened?
My brother just sent me a Snapchat of the score.
Yeah, they just lost to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I didn't see what happened, but I just saw the Snapchat where Messi was all sad on the field, and then Argentina was lost.
What?
It was 2-1, right?
Yeah. So that just happened. Talking still a little bit about the World Cup, I made a tweet that got a little bit of a response, I guess. A lot more of a response on Facebook. It's always fascinating to me too to post the same exact thing on like the three different platforms and just to see the difference in the comment section. Because Facebook is wow. If anything, I mean, I guess Twitter gets a little political here and there, but Facebook goes down the deep end real fast. So I posted, if you didn't see the United States Wales game, they basically had, you know, they did the national anthem for both teams at the beginning. And I wasn't saying that I believe that you should be belting out the national anthem. What I was basically saying was like, there was a stark difference between the United States players and the, I believe is it Welsh players? Is that the correct terminology, I guess?
I believe so.
The players that play for Wales. There was a stark difference between the two. On the Wales side, every single player was mouthing the words, like, right, and singing at certain points very loudly. On the United States side, there was only a handful, maybe two or three guys that were actually doing that. Then there was a few that weren't doing anything. And then there was a couple that were like doing the, where you question, do they actually know the words? Because that was my thing, is like, if you know the words, but you don't want to sing it, right? You can kind of just be like, and we've seen this before in like football games. The most famous one I can think of is the, oh my gosh, was the running back that had a tear coming down before the football, the in it, or was it college foot national championship? I can't remember, but we have seen like obviously a bunch of national anthems across a bunch of different sports and how athletes handle it differently, right? My thing is like, I just thought it was very interesting to see the two side by side. Had we been playing a country and no one was really singing it and they're just standing there, I don't think I would have noticed or said anything. I just thought it was very interesting seeing the difference between the two. And then that just like spurred an entire, like, well, our country sucks. People are like, well, we don't have, patriotism is like frowned upon now. And you just had all these different sides coming from everything. And I wasn't even necessarily even saying anything about like, yeah, it was crazy how you can just make a small little statement like that of like something that you have observed. And then it just opens the floodgates to where people then perceive it how they
see it through their lens.
Correct. Yeah. And then they just go off the deep end. So
what I felt like when I read the tweet, and someone said this, but I think the way they said it was a little weird. They said, like, we're not a singing culture, which I think I understand what they were saying.
Did you see my response? My response was legendary.
Your response was fun.
My response was
really good.
The 80s
college night. But I think I see what they were saying, because I come from like a similar standpoint. Is like, in America, I think a lot of times we use like silence as respect.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, a lot of times, like when the national anthem, when like, I don't think singing it's disrespectful, but I think some players are on the other side of the fence where they stand there and like the silence is their show of respect for the national anthem. Because like when I was growing up, like we were taught you're quiet during the national anthem, you know, hand over your heart, standing there as respect for the country.
Yep.
And so I think that like that's a difference too, because like other cultures are more on the like belt your national anthem as a sign of respect and patriotism. And then I think the middle of the road is just like that uncomfy level where like you just, you know, maybe they saw Wales singing and they're like, oh, I guess, are we supposed to sing our national anthem right now?
Wales went second.
Wales went second? Okay. But like, you know what I'm saying? It's like that.
No, I've seen this of where you're there, or like any military service members, they just stand at salute. They don't sing.
Yeah.
I've seen like the hands behind the back, like looking down kind of thing. Like I've seen it all. I think it was just, for me, I think it was the players that were kind of doing the mumble.
That doesn't say the mumble. That's like a classic, like if you've been at church and like the person next to you, like they're singing during worship, but like they don't really want to sing too loud because they're embarrassed of their voice or whatever. You know what I mean? It's just like the classic, you have to like, you're saying like, is this person even like singing? Like their mouth's moving, but nothing's coming out.
Yeah.
I think that's a very like typical like American singing in a choir. I don't know. Yeah. It just felt like when you said it, I was like, I can like all three of them. I'm like, yeah, I know all three of those people. And like, yeah. I feel like all three of them can come from the exact same thing of like, they're all showing respect just in different ways.
Yeah. I think to me, it was just the most interesting was just, again, seeing how everyone viewed it completely differently.
You know,
because then some people like defended them and were like, well, they weren't even born in this country, or like half of them don't even live in this country. And then I saw someone respond to that being like, well, everyone on the Wales team doesn't live in Wales.
Yeah.
And they all, so like, it was just, it's so interesting to see how everyone took it. We'll see what I work up when we play England. Cause
the I was battle telling, to call it I, soccer.
Well, I was telling Kelsey this too. Like, this is going to be like the first time that they sing God Save the King, because it's been God Save the Queen. So this might be, this might be one of the more electric national anthems in years. Because, I mean, they already go nuts in the past, but like, this is the first time that they sing God Save the King. So we'll see how that works out.
What do they do if they have a king and queen? It's a king? Yeah.
What do they do if they have a king and queen?
Because I've just never even thought of it being a different national anthem.
I don't think you can have a king and queen.
How could you not? Am I wrong?
Because it has to be blood, and only one person can... Oh, you're saying if... Okay.
Because you can have like a prince and a princess, right? Like if you marry a prince, you're a princess.
Oh, yeah. No, you're
right.
Or
vice versa.
Right. I guess there's...
Is it God Save the King and Queen?
Well, no. They didn't. Okay, we're going to be sounding really dumb to our European listeners right now.
To start off, you just blew my mind when you said God Save the King, because I didn't know that was even a thing. I just it's always been God Save the Queen.
But the thing is, like, there wasn't a king, right? There wasn't a king when there was a queen.
All right, I'm Googling this.
So I think they just had to make someone king because the queen died.
Correct.
So in what scenario would there ever be a king and a queen?
But is it just always God Save the Queen?
It's whoever's running the country. It's just been a queen for a really long time. Yeah, I don't think they've ever had a king and a queen at the same time. I don't think they... That wouldn't make any sense. Because at first I thought what you said, it was like, okay, well, if the royal family had a son and a daughter, then yes, they would be a prince and a princess. But whoever ended up taking the crown, they would be the king or the queen. But then I don't think the other person would be the king or the queen. Like, yeah, I don't think...
I think you're right.
But if one of them passed away, then the other one would take it.
That's fascinating. The national anthem just changes now.
It's also still wild that we have kings and queens. Like, that's like,
well, they don't actually hold power, correct? They're just...
It's still not talked about enough. Well, maybe it is. Actually, probably it's talked about too much now I think about it. The people that actually pay attention to that stuff probably talked about too much. Heck, they even have their own like Netflix show.
the fact of the national anthem
Kelsey just dominated Silas here with the statistics.
Oh, get wrecked,
coming
Silas.
In.
Silas wasn't even typing. I was doing my own research over here.
All right, so Kelsey asks, can you have a king and a queen?
I think Silas forgets he has a mic. He was just like looking at me, mouthing stuff.
Can you have a king and a queen at the same time? Yes, but you don't have to. When a king is crowned, his wife usually becomes queen or some variation of the title. Queen Elizabeth II, mother, also Elizabeth, became queen consort. I don't know what that word means. When her husband was crowned king and was most known as the queen mother. Take that for what you will. Very confusing stuff. I'll stick to my Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to talk about was some of the backlash we were getting in the comment section of our Prada video. And I got a little bit on the video we posted on my channel. And I was seeing, obviously, some people didn't like the shortness in the video.
Yeah.
Is the audio content. Is the audio right now fine, Silas?
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good.
Okay. So a little bit of backlash on the length, which it is what it is. Like you said, bonus content, extra video. But I want to give a little kind of more context of what happened, because I think some people, it didn't get put in my video, which I think kind of hurt the storyline a little bit. I don't know if it was put in. I didn't watch the full beginning of the video on Foundation's channel, but were the tweets put in there at all or no? Do you know?
I think you just showed the receipt.
Okay. So I think adding a little context helps. Someone had mentioned or sent me a tweet with this Frisbee. Okay. Kelsey jokingly said like, ooh, or something along the lines of like, ooh, this looks nice, yada, yada, yada. I then jokingly said, if this gets an X, I can't even remember how many, 500, 700, 1,000, something like that. If this gets this many retweets, I'll buy it.
Yeah.
Well, it ended up getting that many retweets. So it's like, I'm going to buy it. What the heck?
Yeah.
So we bought it. The other thing though, I was already very curious as to like what this actually was, because we know like what the lengths and stuff it takes to actually make a Frisbee, like to get a mold and all that. So I was very curious because there was no information on the website of like where it came from, if Prada was actually manufacturing it or whatnot. It turns out they just bought basically what do you call it? A stamp disc?
Yeah, it's just like a custom stamped. I think it was made by like XCOM or something.
Yeah, which is the Chinese company. They
basically Whammo.
Yeah, they basically just did that. And so again, very fascinating to see everything. I was also very curious to see like how it was going to be packaged. It was packaged like it was a Prada purse, which I thought was very interesting. And it came with the Prada satchel, which I'm curious actually how much that costs. That actually might cost like $100 just by itself potentially, because again, the Prada name does hold a lot of weight. So that's where the whole idea of the video came from. I think some people kind of missed that and didn't really understand that it was kind of a joke a little bit of where it was like...
A lot of it.
I mean, obviously a lot of it, but we were serious in the sense of like when we first got it. Obviously, when we had did the foundation video, we had already did the review and all that stuff. So at that point, we were like, this is just a Frisbee with the Prada logo on it. But when me and Kelsey initially got it and we did the unboxing, we that was a serious unboxing of like, I'm very curious as to what is in this box.
Yeah.
But clearly when it was like, oh, I know.
It's just a Frisbee.
It's just a Frisbee. I've literally have thrown this thousands of times.
Yeah.
That's where the joke kind of like, okay, it's a $700 disc. So one to clear the air there. I think there was a few people that were confused.
No. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It was I think part of it too is those videos we like shot them back in Charleston in July.
So then,
you know, we just had so many other pieces of content coming out. You went back on tour. We forgot about it for a little bit. And then we finally like, let's get back to this and post it, to where like even people who might have known the context, like forgot about the tweet exchange and all that, because it just took so long to get around to actually getting it out. So I think that's just some of it. Another of it is just like, some people are just going to be upset. I mean, it is a very weird prompt for a video, like spending $700 on what ended up being a Whammo Frisbee with a strap. So
yeah, but
there's always going to be some people upset about that.
But what if we spend $1,000 a couple year next year on a Frisbee and it's like made out of gold?
Yeah, like, that'd be sick. I mean, didn't someone show like a carbon fiber Frisbee?
Yes, that would also be disgusting.
This is a Chanel one. I think.
How much was it, Silas? It's like $5,000.
$5,000.
What, the carbon fiber?
Yeah.
Yeah. Chanel. Let me find this thing.
Wait, Chanel came out with a carbon fiber one. Yeah. See, now that piques my interest even more.
I can only find it on like a secondhand store.
Yeah. That's right though. But don't they sell like other luxury items and stuff?
I don't know. Like I can see it on Poshmark. No, I can see it on Tradesy.
There's like some. It's like Grail. On some different website that's not Chanel.
Yeah, like it's like some. It's like people like bought it on Chanel and now are flipping it.
And they're flipping it. Interesting.
On Poshmark, it's $7,360.
Oh my gosh!
Black carbon fiber CC logo Frisbee.
Yeah, like what? Oh,
this looks like a disc.
This
doesn't even look like a Frisbee. No, it's a Frisbee. It's a Frisbee. It's like a lid. It almost looks like a polecat. There's a carbon fiber polecat out there for people who want it. You just got to pay $7,000. Is Chanel.com Chanel's website? All right, let's go to Chanel. I'm in America.
Just search Frisbee.
I'm going to just search
Frisbee. See what shows up.
See if it's on there.
Maybe they only made one and it got sold and now they don't have it.
There's no results for Frisbee. Yeah, I don't know.
Interesting.
It just is out there. Carbon fiber Chanel Frisbee. If this podcast gets 15,000 likes, we will buy that and play with it. That's fair. 15,000 likes. I think that can be the goal.
You know what I'm watching right now? I'm watching that Pepsi documentary about the Jet. Oh, you haven't heard about this?
No.
So this is back. This might have been like back before like the loyalty points and all that thing was a thing.
Okay.
Someone at Pepsi was like, hey, what if we come up with this idea of where like the more Pepsi you buy, the more Pepsi points you get, which you then can purchase like cool Pepsi merchandise and all that stuff. And they're like, oh, yeah. Okay, sweet. And at this time, Pepsi's big thing to try to take Coke down, which obviously was like the first cola brand and all that, was all about marketing. So like, you know, the beginning of this documentary talks all about how they were getting all these big name athletes, all these celebrities, they were making these sick commercials, all this. And so they had this really cool idea to sell more Pepsi, but they had a hard time like the idea of like getting it out to the masses of putting it in a commercial. It's like not, they're basically saying it's not like the sexiest thing of like, hey, buy more of our Pepsi and then basically be a billboard for us walking around with your Pepsi jacket and stuff.
Yeah, you can
right?
get like t-shirts and stuff. Yeah.
They're like, how do we make that sexy? How do we make that into a commercial that, you know, tells people? So the commercial starts and it's this kid walking out of his bedroom with a Pepsi shirt. And at the bottom, it's like Pepsi shirt, 70 Pepsi points. And then he's walking, and he puts on his like leather jacket. It's like Pepsi leather jacket, 1200 Pepsi points. He puts on like his Pepsi sunglasses, 500 Pepsi points, right? And then the whole thing is just talking over, there's like some narration going on. That's not very important. And then all of a sudden he just like drops into his school on a Harrier jet, just and like the thing opens up and he's like something about like how taking the bus isn't that cool to do anymore or whatever, right? And the commercial ends that says like Harrier jet, 7 million Pepsi points. But there's no fine print. There's nothing at all, right? And all the Pepsi people were like, obviously this is a joke. This is not serious. But this one dude was like, this one dude took it seriously of wait yeah. a second and like did the math and basically figured out that a Harrier jet is between something like $28 and $30 million and accumulating 7 million Pepsi points. And he did the math of like, that's like, it's like 1.4 million bottles of Pepsi or something. And like how many warehouses they would have to have and how they would have to have workers to pull the Pepsi points off the bottles and all this stuff. And his math basically made it to where it was going to cost him like $4.3 million to do it, to get 7 million Pepsi points. And I mean, you do the math, you spend $4 million to get something worth $30 million. Kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm at right now. So yeah. So like I'm deep into this first episode and it's fascinating, but yeah, that's, you reminded me of that, of where you know, I can't remember what you said, but you said something.
15,000 likes to get the
yes
Frisbee. But I meant it. If this podcast gets 15,000 likes.
Well, I know, but I'm saying is like, that's something where you just out of your mind, you're like, there's no chance. The execs were saying there's no chance anyone ever will get 7 million Pepsi points. And now you're here saying there's no chance we get 15,000 likes. But if everyone that listens to this likes it on YouTube, then yes, it will get 15,000 likes. And we will have to buy that Frisbee.
That is a fair point. Maybe I should have said it a little higher, but it's too late now. The words are out of my mouth.
I feel like 30,000 or something to where it's like we would have to double our listeners.
You live and you learn.
We'll see. Okay, we'll see.
We'll see what happens.
Other thing I wanted to talk about... No, that's pretty much it, actually.
All right, well, I've got a few things.
Okay, yeah. What do you got?
I don't know if you saw the Drew Gibson elevated basket tweet.
Yeah, I had someone mention that saying like, oh, you guys should talk about that. And I was like,
I wanted to bring up, I've talked about it enough. But. We've talked about elevated baskets a lot. So I don't really want to go over everything about the tweet.
I love them. I love elevated baskets.
But I did think he brought up, he wasn't really making this like his main point he parked on, but I think he brought up a great question within it. So I'll just read his tweets and then I'll bring up what I thought was fascinating about it. So he said, shout out to any and all course designers. When you raise the basket slash target, you then alter how the target slash basket was designed to catch. The process of designing a basket is based at X height, and the PDGA won't approve it unless it meets those standards. Why is raising it okay? And then he goes on to keep talking through. His biggest point, I think, was when you raise it, it alters how it's designed to catch. My biggest question, though, I thought we hadn't come across, because like that part, then the easy counter argument is like, well, so does putting it on a steep hill or a steep downslope. That's the same thing. But my part that I, you know, thought, I think we've talked about it somewhat, but I hadn't ever looked into it. But like the PDGA does have a like range for like a championship level basket where from the ground to the top of the cage, I believe it's 82 centimeters with a 6 centimeter forgiveness thing on either side for the basket to be approved.
Okay.
So what I think is fascinating is like, why does that exist if once the basket's approved, it can then be raised, however, at tournaments? Like that is an interesting point that, you know, I pulled out of his tweet there of like, why does that exist if it can just be changed?
It can be lowered as well, right?
Yeah, like what I saw is the basket has to be that height to be approved, but then like tournaments can do whatever they want.
Yeah, if you bury the basket, it's still like an approved basket, but it's just buried in the ground a little bit.
Yeah, so I guess the question is like, why have the standard on approval if you're not going to regulate the usage?
That's a good question. I think maybe it just has to do with, you know, they want just a standardized basket, so that way when you aren't manipulating it, it's just... Because like what... Are people going to come out with mini baskets? Like this basket's only 2 feet off the ground and this basket's 5 feet off the ground. Like that doesn't seem.
Well, like I could see course designers if Discraft came out with a chain star that already had a 6.5 foot pole to where you didn't have to go figure that out. Like I could see course designers being like, oh, I want the elevated basket.
Don't they just change out the pole? I don't know. I haven't looked too much.
They do now, but like a tournament course designer is the one that has to go do it. So I'm saying like if companies were like able to make them that were already like pre-packaged.
Yeah, but this shipping one's elevated, a 6.5 foot pole is probably more expensive than just
tough.
Yeah, I know. I still don't even know how that works. That seems like a lot of money. It's a very heavy item. But
yeah,
no, I mean, you make a good point of where, you know, should they be regulating more so how the baskets are used versus, yeah. Because, I mean, do they regulate anything on, do they regulate anything on tee pads? Because I've played a C-tier event where we just had like they definitely don't regulate anything on tee pads. Because I've played in tons of temporary tee pads where it's literally just like two flags.
The only thing they you're might just throwing, is for like different tiers.
Yeah. That's what I wonder. Like, oh, maybe not. I think the Disc Golf Pro Tour maybe does their own thing and like the PDGA doesn't really have anything with tee pads.
Now that you say that, I feel like I have at like big tournaments played where there's a flag that extends. Like if you want to throw from the grass, you can.
Well, we've done that on pro tour events too, when the tees are really bad.
I guess
bad
like if it
has
a like, I'm trying. I'm scrolling through the.
But that would be like an that'd be an interesting one too. Of like, if they come out and they're like, all right, tee pads need to be 10
earth
feet.
Earth tee pads are not allowed at majors or elite series. It just says earthen tee pads are not allowed.
Okay, so at every other event,
at majors and elite series is the only thing in there.
So here's the thing, though. This would be the same thing of where, like, let's say they were even a little bit more specific and they're like, tee pads need to be 5 feet wide, 10 feet length at a minimum, right?
Yeah.
But you could have some courses do like the Rip Revenge thing of where they put a tee pad in like a weird, you know, where a tree limb is sticking out over. I've played some courses where, you know, you have to throw from further back off the, further back from the tee pad than you would like normally because there's like a tree right by the front.
Yeah, so you're like, I don't. Hand.
Yeah. So like that would be the similar in the sense of where like they are structuring something to where, okay, every course has to have it this way, but then you can have these other things come into play that now cause it to be different, similar to the basket. I don't know. Again, I think a lot of learning stuff is coming from it, but also I will say, like, I love elevated baskets and I love changing, whether it's on a hill or down a hill or up on a pole or whatever it may be. I think there obviously can come a time and place where it gets a little too excessive and a little too gimmicky, i.e. like Texas State's hole one or the more famous hole, which is out at Eagles Crossing, like the big cake hole.
Yeah.
Of where now, like, you know, you're throwing, I don't know. I think you can get a little crazy, but I like them. I think, and I'm also a fan of too, where I don't think you should necessarily have a free throw every time you putt. And
yeah,
the way I, you know, shoot the same exact way no matter where you putt. I think adding in the elements of where you have low ceilings sometimes to where now you have to straddle out, or you have to get down on one knee, or you have to throw an Anheuser, or you got to throw like a hyzer that drops in. Like, I think adding more elements to the putting area and having people have to putt differently, I think is the only defense disc golf really has, because we don't have any other defense. Like, what?
Yeah. Well, that brings up two things. Well, first off, like, 'cause Drew's point in the tweet was essentially he was calling elevated baskets lazy course design, because more or less, like, if that's all you do to a green to make it hard, then you didn't really, like, from what I got from his tweet, he was basically saying, like, you didn't really try to make the green hard if you were just like, oh, well, to make this difficult, we'll elevate a basket. But, like, for some greens, A, there isn't going to be, like, the perfect defense because of how good the hole, like, you could have a great hole and then you get to the green, you're like, man, it just needs a little something. And I think elevated basket's a good option there, because also you can make a green where, you know, the whole left side's death, it's only accessible from this area. But then when you get to that area, it could be like, well, if you throw this shot though, you have a super easy putt. And it kind of like makes the hole super simple, because it's like, oh, just dump out right and you have a wide open putt with no risk. But then you elevate the basket, even though you designed a green that requires you to go to the right, elevate the basket, it at least adds another thing to think through. But what you were just saying of like building up the fence was another thing I wanted to bring up, was like, in golf, you talk a lot about like when the tour comes to a course, you know, they can change the length of the grass. They can make the greens harder and faster. Obviously they can change pin locations, tee location. They do a lot to like make the course into like a tour level.
Yeah. They buff it like, up.
In disc golf right now, I feel like a lot of times what'll happen is that happens at some places where it's possible, but a lot of times it's like there's tour courses and there's like fun courses, but I don't think you necessarily want a like fully tour level course to be something that just like average players, you know, can play every day, if that makes sense. Like, because it won't really be fun if the course is built to challenge the very top of the game and be that hard, and that's the only way the course is built. Then like an average player, I'll go have fun at it like once or twice. But if I'm going to play every day, I'm not choosing that course. So if you're a place right now that's trying to get a lot of traffic to your course, you know, you don't really want to just come out with like the toughest, hardest tour level course. So what are some things you think like disc golf in our current situation where we don't have full control over most of the properties? Like, is there things we can do to make courses tour ready when the tour is coming to town? Like, are there ways to design a good course for average players that then you can like snap your fingers and turn into a tour course?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to it, you know, when we don't have, obviously Maple Hill, they do control the land and everything out there, yeah. Right? They own all that. I'd be very interested in talking to, was it Steve Dodge that designed the course?
I believe so.
I'd be interested in hearing his, like how he went about, like what was his process in designing the course? Because the gold layout there, the layout that we play when we go out there, is not often played by people that go out there, amateurs or people that are just, like you said, trying to have fun or whatever. It might be one of those, like, let's say you and Trevor went up there for the weekend.
Yeah.
You guys might play it the first time, But then after that, you're like, all right, let's play blues. Let's play reds. Let's play whites. And you'll never go back and play the golds. It's probably a one and done situation for you. So I'm curious as to, did they set up the course? Because I think with what you would do, and I'm curious if this is right, is I would set up the course for the hardest, longest, what the tour is going to come in and play it. Like, yeah. Set it up that way. And then once I have that course set up, similar to like New London, once you have the course set up, then you can come back and figure out where can we put tee pads that are shorter that maybe make the hole a little bit different, but easier, right? Mm-hmm. And now you have two right there. You have the longs and the shorts. And then if you want, you can find like a medium in between. And now you have a long, short, and a medium. And then you could do like a family one where it's like people that really, you know, put them way down the fairway or whatever. I think that's probably the best way of doing it, because to me, it would be so much harder to make a course to where you're like, this is what like a local amateur player can come out and play this course and have fun. You make that course and now you're like, okay, how do we extend it? Yeah. I feel like you're just going to get in the way of the other holes, and it's going to be tough.
That was like the trend. If you go back in course design a few years ago, the mindset shifted, I think, a lot more to what you just explained, where you design the hardest top level course first, and then it's a lot easier to add short tees in because you've already cut the line. And now you're just like, you might just cut a little like offset to the tee, or you might not even have to cut anything else in at all to put a short tee in. But what used to happen in like a lot of courses, and I'm sure there's disc golfers listening that like still have this feeling, like when you hear long tees, it a lot of times puts a bad taste in your mouth, because like at least around here and like a lot of courses I've played, what would happen is like the park would want a course designed and made for everyday players, which makes sense. They want traffic. So that's the course that's designed. Then the local disc golf scene would want something harder. And so they would just kind of throw in long tees. And so what long tees essentially meant was just walk 50 feet into the woods without cutting in, slap a tee pad down, and now you have a harder lengthwise course with gaps that are like 3 feet wide or with no gaps. And like that's the blue tees or the long tees. And so like in disc golf, like the East Campus course at Liberty, that was like one of the stereotypical blue tee courses, in my opinion, where like the white tees is a good time. You can go out there and have fun. The blue tees have gotten better. But when I first went, like was at school there, you'd play the blue tees because you would think like, oh, like, you know, I want a challenge. I'm gonna play the blue tees. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was brutal. Like there were several holes where the shot from the blue tee was to lay up to the white tee so you could actually play the hole. And like it just made it where the course sucked. It was no fun. So we ended up just playing a mix where the good blue tees, you play those and then play all the white tees. But had the course been designed with the blue tees first, it could have been like the property wise could have been a championship level course. And then the white tees probably would have played the same. It just would have been cut in from the blues. And so like that's what New London did, like you said. And I think that's the perfect way to do it, because now you go and play New London from the whites. You have a great time. It's scoreable. You still have the feel of a championship level course. Because of the way it's maintained, you're still playing the similar lines that you've seen pros throw, because you're playing just a shortened version of the long course. And when a course is designed that way, it makes it great where the pro tour can come in and they probably won't have to do much, if anything at all, to the course. But then day-to-day players can still, you know, have typical traffic to the course all the time.
Yeah, and I think obviously when you were talking about like a wide open course. So a course, like let's say on an old golf course or something like that. I think you can just simply have, you know, a par three that's 410 feet and then 380 feet, 350 feet, 300 feet. And right there, everyone's going to be throwing essentially the same shot, but from a different distance that suits their skill level. That makes sense. I think it's trickier when you get into woods golf that is not woods golf like New London. And for most of the people listening, I'm sure you've watched us play at New London, so you get the gist of what that woods golf looks like. of where it's fairways. For the most part, there's a couple that aren't like this, but for the most part, it's fairways and then woods.
Yeah.
And there's not trees and all sorts of different gaps and all that stuff in the middle of the fairway. I think, again, there you can have a par four that's 800 feet longs, 720 feet, 650 feet, 580 feet. And that would be a good hole for all those different skill levels.
Yeah.
I think it's trickier when you go to a course that is more built on the gaps and more built on, and the easiest way of seeing this is like just looking at some of the holes. If you've played these courses, looking at the holes that MPO plays versus FPO and just seeing how sometimes for MPO, the hole is so hard. And then for FPO, it's not that hard of a hole for them. Even though it's only 30 feet shorter, that 30 feet takes out three gaps or something like that that the MPO has to hit, right? And it can be also vice versa of where sometimes the MPO, they put us in a spot of where it's like, oh, we have a big hyzer. And then they make FPO, because it's shorter, have to hit a gap. And like now that hole's harder for FPO from a shorter tee pad.
Yeah.
So I think when it comes to like gap hitting and all that stuff, it can get a little bit more dicey versus just like, oh, it's shorter, it's going to be easier when you are changing up the actual shot. So that's what I have to say about that.
Makes sense. All right. I have one final kind of like prompt or question, if you will, because this is something that just happened to me. I just had this idea. So I, little context, my anniversary was this past weekend. And
congratulations.
Thank you. My wife, 5 years. 5 years married, 10 years dating.
What is that? That's what's five? Is that gold? Is five gold?
I have no idea what you're referencing.
You don't even know what I'm talking about?
No. Silas, you tracking with him? You know what he's saying?
Silas, wait, really? I thought this was like a... I mean, I know a lot of people don't do it, but I still thought people knew about it. You're supposed to do... Not supposed to, sorry. It's like... It's like an older thing of where like every year is like something different, where like 1 year is like, all right, here we go. Wait, what the heck? Hold on. All right. Traditional. It's very traditional. So it's like an older thing. I think it's okay. First anniversary, paper. So a gift's supposed to be from paper. Second, fiber. Third, leather. Flowers is fourth. Fifth is wood.
Wood. Okay. I can figure something out.
Okay.
So 50th, far, this is great. This is very, very achievable.
50th is gold.
50th so is gold. Okay. Yeah, so they I got 45 wait. Years to save.
Yeah. I mean, you got, I mean, six is candy. So like that's like.
Easy.
Easy. Seven is copper. Psst, a little pricey.
You can cut a pipe out of my plumbing.
Eighth is bronze. Then you got pottery, steel, silk, lace, ivory, crystal, wax. This is fascinating.
I've never heard
60,
of it.
If you make it a 60, it's diamond.
Diamond, so, 60. All right.
There you go. But yeah, that's diamond. Like a it's like a more old traditional thing.
All right. Well, there you go. You something new.
Yeah. There you go. So fifth anniversary.
Fifth anniversary. My wife's like favorite place is the Greenbrier, which is like just a resort, has some golf course and stuff on it. It's like 2 hours north of us. So we went there, and while we were there, like they have like golf, tennis, horseback riding, hiking trails, like all these different amenities. And like they have this one part that's called the like Greenbrier Outdoor Club, which is where you go if you want to go to like the shooting range, you want to sign up for the horseback or carriage ride or the off-roading and stuff like that. I was like, man, disc golf like almost fits into that vibe. And then I was like telling Liz that. I was like, you know, like with hiking trails and stuff, it's really easy to put a disc golf course in with the trails already cut out. And I was like, how would you even go about pitching disc golf to a place like that? Because like there's so many places that exist where they have like hiking trails and all of this, to where like most of the work of the disc golf course is essentially cut in, right? Mm-hmm. They would just need to put the money in for tee pads and baskets. And then the maintenance, again, if it's on a place that's already done with like hiking trails and stuff, isn't really that much more. So it's like, from one standpoint, it's a no-brainer for places, because it's like, oh, you can pay almost a one-time fee and have another thing to offer guests. But on the flip side of that coin, disc golf's not at a popularity level that, like, for a majority of people that are coming to a lot of places, it's not like a make or break, like, oh, I'm not going because they don't have disc golf, right? Or you might even read it and be like, what the heck is this? So what would be, if you were to go to any type of like resort or thing like that, I don't know what's like a ski resort or in this case, just like a golf resort and pitch disc golf. What's your like sales pitch on it?
I mean, here's the problem. Okay.
Let's start with the problem. Interesting way to start a sales pitch.
Yeah. Well, we're going to try to talk through it because I think pitching this idea is not going to work. Like, you can't just have a good sales pitch and it work for every single situation because I think it would only work for certain situations, and the situations being ones that have a lot of land that they don't know what to do with it and they are just kind of in limbo. You can pitch them, hey, while you're trying to figure out what to do with this, you know, whether you're going to put new construction or turn it into tennis courts or basketball court, whatever. When you're trying to figure out what you're going to do with this, like, let's just throw some baskets out there and make a disc golf course. Because the problem with disc golf is it's not a money generator.
Yeah.
Right? So you're not by putting disc golf into those hiking trails, let's say, you're not all of a sudden massively increasing the green buyer is not massively increasing their revenue.
Yeah.
Where if they put a new golf course in, you're going to now get a lot of people to travel in to play that new golf course that have maybe played the other ones, but haven't played the new one, want to try it out. Now they're staying there. Now they're eating your food. Big revenue generator. The disc golf is going to be more of a, you know, again, don't take this the wrong way, all my disc golf enthusiasts out there, because I'm one as well. But for the most part, it's going to be viewed as kind of like a resort having a shuffleboard. Where you're like, oh, wow, this resort has a shuffleboard. That's awesome.
Exactly.
Like, that's bonus.
Like, it's a fun add-on, but you're not traveling there because I got shuffleboard.
Disc golf has not, at least I haven't seen it yet. And again, you got Eagles Crossing out there. And you got Maple Hill basically as the two that are trying to make this pay to play kind of happen.
But Maple Hill's at least got like another revenue source.
Exactly.
Like
they're not sole on disc golf. But
yeah.
I just haven't seen myself in the group of people that I play with here. I play with a ton of amateurs, local guys here. I don't see them. They go up to Dinosaur Valley, which is a little north of here, but that's because one of the guys in our group owns that, and like, that's his course and all that. It doesn't have the same culture as golf does of where you can make a guy's trip and travel somewhere to play a course. It could get there. I'm not saying it can't, but I know right now it's not. So selling that point to someone would be tough because I do not think it's going to be a huge revenue generator. Now, where I think it makes sense is Princeville out in Hawaii, when we went out and did that Hawaii trip and played the golf course out there, they had, I believe, a 24-hole course at one point, or maybe they had two 18-hole courses. I can't remember exactly what it was. But essentially, they're like, we're just going to take the best land for these two courses we have or these 24 holes that we have and just turn that into an 18-hole course. And what ended up happening is they have six or eight or nine holes that they kind of just did to the wayside of where it's like, these are kind of not on the ocean, whatever, whatever, the throwaway holes. And so they didn't maintain or keep up with those holes. And now they're in this thing of like, what are they going to do? Now, eventually they probably are going to put property there, right? They're probably going to have villas or add more hotel, whatever. But as of right now, they don't have anything. And so they were like, oh, so someone pitched them the disc golf idea. And they're like, yeah, I mean, we're not maintaining it really. So like, that doesn't hurt us. And so that does bring in a little bit of extra revenue for people that are already on the island or people that do go there for golf and are like, oh, they have a disc golf course too. Like, oh, that's cool. Let's play that. I just don't know anyone from the States that's flying into Princeville to play the disc golf course. Right. Yeah. So to them, like, that's a no brainer because it's like, it's just sitting there.
You're not doing anything else with land.
That's what the problem with what you said though, the hiking thing, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like having the scooter riders show up to the skate park. Right, of where you might have a lot of people that really enjoy the hikes and all that, and now all of a sudden you got discs flying in and all that. Like, are you now causing a little bit of a chaos of, or the same notion of like disc golfers on golf courses, of yeah. where a golf course might be not being able to fill up their tee sheet every day, so they're like, all right, let's put a disc golf course in, and we'll have times where disc golf can come play. Now you have golfers that are pissed off that disc golfers are out there. Like, I don't think you're going to have this synergy of like, oh yeah, the hikers are going to love that discs are now being tossed around when they go.
That's
on a
true.
Hike.
That's very
so
true.
So that's the other thing you have to worry about on like usage of land that's already being used for something else, adding something to it.
Yeah.
Is it going to take away at all for the people that are already using it? But
yeah, because that's what when we went out to Jackson Hole, they had like a ski resort there, and we went mm-hmm. in July because we were going out to Yellowstone and
Jackson
like Grand
Hole
Teton
is phenomenal, by the way.
Park. Yeah, it was incredible. And when we were at the like I forget what the ski like resort part was, but the very top of the mountain was still snowy, so they still had some like very limited ski slopes open, but some of like the lower ones on the mountain weren't because there wasn't snow down there. So what they had done was they had cut in that was only available during the off season of skiing and snowing. They had cut in like mountain bike trails, and then mm-hmm. looping within the mountain bike trails was a disc golf course. And so like a similar thing to what you were saying, like my dad and I, we were there to go. We went to the top cause they had like a waffle restaurant at the top of this mountain. We went and ate waffles up there, and we were coming back down. I was like, there's a disc golf basket right there. What the heck? So we went in the shop, asked, it was $5 for a round. And my dad and I were like, oh, well, since we're here, let's yep. rent some discs. And so it was like $5 for the round. I think it was a few bucks to rent some discs. So they ended up, you know, making, let's just say $15 off my dad and I combined. And we just went, and it was a super easy walk. And while you're on the side of a mountain, so you have like a gorgeous view, played some disc golf. It was a ton of fun, but that was like a circumstantial mm-hmm. way of like, we're already there. We weren't there for disc golf. I didn't even know they had a disc golf course. I just happened to see a basket, ask about it. And then, yeah, they made $10 or $15 off us. They wouldn't have had they not had it, but it wasn't something like everyone in the area was talking about, like, and everyone was there to play this disc golf course. Like, we were literally, while we were playing, there was just signs you had to pay attention because like mountain bikers were using it and like would come across your fairway, and you just had to like watch out for the mountain bikers and stuff. It was a very multi-use thing, but the whole reason it existed was they had this land that for 3 or 4 months out of the year they couldn't use.
They had nothing going on, yeah.
And so they were like, we need something on this land. And it was just easy way to put natural tee pads and some disc golf baskets, and that was it. It was
yeah, and
fun.
I think, yeah, I would say I think as people get more exposed to disc golf, those type of situations make more and more sense.
Yeah.
Because you have a larger pool of people that having a disc golf course, like you said, might not be the make or break on whether or not they visit there or go there, but could be a fun additional add-on of where yeah. it's like, oh, sick. Like, yeah, I know what disc golf is. It'd be fun to play here. Let's do it.
I'd be curious, because you're talking, it's very true. Like, golf courses that have disc golf on them, golfers get very annoyed with disc golfers, and it's caused a lot of issues because, like, you already have something being used for one thing, and then you just add yes. something to it. I would be very curious of like what tennis players think of pickleball. Like, cause like a lot of tennis courts are just being doubled used as pickleballs. So like at, for instance, at the Greenbrier, they now offer pickleball, and I saw a lot of people carrying pickleball paddles, mm-hmm. but they just are using the indoor tennis courts and the outdoor tennis courts to play pickleball on. And like, I could see where that'd be frustrating if you show up to play tennis with your friends and you walk up and like all the courts are being used by pickleball players. Like, I wonder if it's a similar vibe, like if tennis players can't stand pickleball or anything like that.
No, I mean, for the ones where, you know, they're either converting, right? They're converting yeah. tennis courts to pickleball courts, or they're simply just playing pickleball on tennis courts. I can 100% guarantee that tennis players are like, what the heck? This is bogus.
Yeah.
Same thing as like, you know, like indoor racquetball courts, right? Like if you were going to go play racquetball and you show up and like two of the courts are being occupied by like, I don't know, dodgeball or something that does not involve racquetball, you're going to be like, well, what the heck, man? Yeah. I think whenever a facility is being used by something that it wasn't designed to be used by, and the person that shows up to use it that way, like they're going to be annoyed. Now, is anyone in the wrong? Not necessarily, but
yeah,
you're just going to have people that are annoyed. And I always wonder that too, because I think pickleball is something that I don't think it's going to go anywhere, because I think so many people do love tennis. And as they get older,
it becomes easier to play pickleball.
Correct. And it's the same thing, kind of what we mentioned with golf. Like one of the reasons why golf is so popular is because majority of the time you're just in a golf cart driving around on beautiful courses.
Yeah.
So it's something that you can do for a very, very long time. Tennis is something that you can't do for a very long, long time. As soon as your knees start going, it is not super comfortable. And it's also a sport that is very not fun when you're playing with people that aren't good.
Yeah.
Pickleball, it's very hard to be bad at pickleball.
Yeah.
So I don't see it going anywhere, but do I see it as like a little bit of a fad, like a trend that is very popular right now and is probably going to slowly die out? I think so. Because again, I think it's going to turn into more of an, the way I would view it is I think it's going to turn more, I could be wrong, but it's going to turn more into an older sport,
yeah,
similar to golf.
I'd agree.
And because if you're 20, yeah, if you're 20 years old, like, aren't you playing tennis?
I think the difference is like, if I went out and played pickleball, I could compete with a wide array of people my age. Of like, if someone who's really good at pickleball showed up, it kind of like ping pong. If someone who's incredible at ping pong shows up, I'm not going to be able to play against them. But if someone who's solid at ping pong, I can take them, even if I not win, but I can at least be competitive.
Yes.
Tennis is a much higher barrier to entry, where like, if I play someone who's even decent at tennis, I'm not going to be able to return their serves. Mm-hmm. But like, if me and Trevor go out, we're going to have a fun competitive match because we're similarly skill level. Whereas like, if someone who's just like because of the way pickleball is, you can add spin and stuff like that, but it's very easy to return. So if I can get to the ball, I can return it. And so then it's just like, I don't have to have really high skill and technical knowledge to be able to play pickleball. So someone like me, I would be more, if a bunch of buddies text me and said, hey, let's go play tennis, I'm less likely to say yes than if a bunch of buddies text me and said, let's go play pickleball. Just because, like, yeah, I'm going to have more fun if I play pickleball. So I think that's where it kind of lives. But I definitely
agree. I was
talking
more on the competitive side.
On the competitive side, I definitely agree. It's definitely
like
more of a like older, or like if I could see like casual players, like if there was a pickleball tournament next weekend.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I'm,
I was like, you know what,
like,
I'm going to go enter it. I could see that.
I'm talking more like if you're 16 years old, are you pursuing a pickleball career if you were good enough to play tennis?
No, I think the only way is if you're not good enough to make it in tennis.
Yeah, I don't know. See, like, I would assume, like, if you can't make it in tennis, pickleball is the way for you. And I think the majority of pickleball players that I have seen online, like, the, you know, the clips and stuff that I see in tournaments, and, like, I, you know, I'm assuming they came from a tennis background. Like, they were either a teaching pro or played in college or something, and now they're playing pickleball. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's where it's tough, is I think it's tough when you have someone that is skillful in that area, I guess you could say, of expertise, whether it's the hand-eye, paddle, racket, whatever sport, like them making – pickleball is just going to always be inferior to tennis in that regard, right? Because all the best players are going to go to tennis, you would assume.
You would assume, yeah.
I could be wrong.
I think it'd be a very hard, we talked about this a little last week, of like, disc golf and golf are in slightly different sphere, just because like one's a the actual act of the sports are different, whereas like pickleball and tennis, they're the same sport at the very core essence of
it.
You, like,
if you're really good at tennis, you're going to be good at pickleball, and if you're really good at pickleball, you're going to be good at tennis. Like you're not going to be.
Yeah, I think the tough part
is you can't
be
good at one and bad at the other.
Well, you could be good at pickleball and bad at tennis, but you can't. No. There's no shot you could be great at tennis.
No, I'm talking about like good. I'm talking about like very good at.
Yeah,
I'm talking about very good at pickleball. If you're very good at pickleball, I highly doubt you put a tennis racket in your hand and all of a sudden you're just like, I have no idea what I'm doing.
The only thing would be like a tennis ball is going to be moving way faster than you're ever used to.
Yeah, but
if you didn't have a tennis background.
I'm talking about like the very, very good people. Like you can be very good at golf and be terrible at disc golf. You can be very good at disc golf and be terrible at golf. They're two very different.
They don't translate at all.
They don't have no translation. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the toughest part with like pickleball is just the history to overcome. Of like, you're not going to see pickleball at Wimbledon, at least not anytime soon. And by the time you do, tennis isn't going anywhere in that aspect. And so like, that's gonna be the toughest thing is if you're a 16-year-old and you love pickleball, A, chances are you also love tennis, but B, if you're that good and you know you have a future in both sports, it's going to be hard to turn down millions for thousands.
Well, the media plays such a huge role in this too, because I've been watching some of these CrossFit game documentaries over the last several years.
Yeah.
I completely forgot about the CrossFit games.
Yeah. The only reason I ever watched it was like I had a friend who was into CrossFit and would like come over and turn it on.
But did you know they were happening?
No, I didn't know when they were happening. I knew they existed, but I could not tell you when they happened or anything like that. No.
But like I thought they were done. Like I thought the CrossFit Games was done. Like I haven't heard anything about the CrossFit Games in a very long time.
No, it's been years.
And I don't know if that's because they're not on ESPN2 anymore, ESPN or whatever it may be. But it's so interesting too. Just like I don't know, like Tour de France too. Like some of these things, like when you have a Lance Armstrong, right? And he's all over the news. He's all over SportsCenter. Like it makes the sport pop, and everyone's talking about the Tour de France. Like when was the last time you heard anyone talk about the Tour de France? Like you would almost think like it wasn't happening.
Yeah, anymore. if it hadn't happened since I was in high school, it wouldn't surprise me. Like if it hadn't happened for like 7 or 8 years.
But that's so fascinating because like if you're a diehard cyclist,
yeah,
you probably haven't seen a change, right? Yeah. Because you're still watching it, you're still seeing everything. But if you're a casual, there hasn't been anyone that has like popped off to where it's made the media talk about it, so you don't know about it. And I think that is huge. I think having something like that for some of these sports that are more on the fringe, you need to have that, because NFL, college football, NBA, all these sports in America, they're always going to get pressed. They're always going to be talked about. Everyone's, regardless of whether or not you have another Tom Brady show up or you have another LeBron James or whatever, they're always going to be talked about. But more of these fringe sports that, you know, a Tony Hawk comes in and everyone is like skateboarding, playing the video games, yada, yada. And then bounces. Same thing as like a Tiger Woods.
Yeah.
Right? Like Tiger Woods comes in, changes golf, Tiger Woods leaves. Like I'm still a huge golf fan. I could tell you like, no, man, this guy's sick and this guy's sick. But like there are some athletes that move the needle. And it's like,
yeah,
if pickleball gets one of those, right, that like moves the needle. Like you're not a big MMA guy, are you?
No.
UFC.
But I'll watch some fights if the right people are fighting.
Yeah, like Conor McGregor. Like he got a lot of people, their eyes on MMA. And you need to have those people because you let's say like Conor McGregor got 50 million people. That might be way too many. But 50 million people to tune in to his fights that normally wouldn't. you're going to have 45 million of those people be like, oh, okay, that was cool, and zone out. But you might have 5 million stick around and be like, oh, wow, that's cool. And then they start watching other stuff, and now they turn to fans. So I don't really know what my point of that all was, but I do think it's interesting.
It is fascinating. Like, within a bubble,
CrossFit games were gone.
Yeah, like within, and disc golf falls into this, like within the bubble, we'll have like outside notoriety and like things happen. And like in the bubble, we like freak out over it, but then we go right back to caring about what's going on the next week. And like everyone else forgets disc golf existed to a certain extent. Like Tour de France is a great example of like, nah, I hadn't even heard Tour de France in years, but like you're saying, a diehard cyclist, like they could probably tell me exactly when it happens, who won the last five, whatever. I'm like, I didn't even know it was happening. And golf, on the flip side, like what you were saying about MMA, when Tiger Woods made his return when I was in college, like that was the first time I ever watched a golf tournament. Because I like heard of Tiger Woods and stuff, like, but when most of his career, I was in like middle school, elementary, high school, I don't know, somewhere in that range where like I didn't really care that much. And then he made his return. It was like such a big news story. I was like, well, I've got to tune in. And I think it was the first time he was competitive again. Like the first time he had a shot at a win was when I was like, I've got to tune in. And once I tuned in, that's when I was like, man, golf's kind of fascinating. And that's when I like, because it was the first time I'd actually paid attention to golf to where like they had spin control. I could tell like they were actually shot shaping and stuff. And I'm like, there's way more to this. And the next thing you know, I actually started just like enjoying watching golf. I'm still not like a diehard fan to where like I watch every tournament. But if I sit down,
you didn't watch the RSN?
No. If I sit down and a golf tournament's on, I'm going to turn it on. Like if I'm watching TV, I'm definitely going to tune in and like I'll check my ESPN app and pay attention to like who's doing what. So like Tiger Woods, and I'm sure I'm far from the only one, turned me from like never watching golf to now like a casual viewer. And then I'm sure if he gets in contention, because I know he's playing in December, if he gets in contention again somehow, it might push me even farther into a more diehard golf fan type thing.
That's the Hero World Challenge. That's like a little
still, if he wins, man. There's no dinky tournaments.
There's like 30 people there.
Tiger's one of the 30. There's no dinky tournaments.
I do want to talk about this in a second, though, because I thought this was actually very fascinating here in a second. But yeah, we'll end this talk of where the easiest way, Ultimate Frisbee, I thought it was a lot bigger than it was. As soon as I stopped like being in it, as soon as I stopped playing Ultimate, I didn't hear anyone talking about it.
Yeah.
So it's like as soon as you remove yourself from that bubble, you like realize like, oh, wow. Like
if you don't go looking for information, you're not going to find
it. Like the only people really talking about this are the people that are like in the bubble. So, I think disc golf is a little bit maybe outside of that a little bit, but it'd be cool to see it even more outside. But let's talk a little bit about strength of schedule or strength of the field. Because you brought up like dinky tournament, whatever, whatever. And I saw you. Did you tweet out to Stat Mando asking him what had a better strength of field, Big Germ's wedding or New World?
Yeah, I was pretty proud. I thought that was a very funny tweet. People took it like I was trying to insult Paul somehow. People always try to find something where there's nothing. But I thought it was a very funny tweet.
Oh, well, people thought I was devaluing his win too because it was Paul. No, I would have devalued anyone's win. I was basically devaluing my top 10, saying like I could just show up and play terrible and get a top 10. Like, what other tournament are you doing that? Lake Marshall actually had a weaker strength of schedule.
Yeah, I saw that on Stat Mando.
Than New World, which I thought was interesting. But going into it a little bit, I was listening to my go-to golf podcast, and they are kind of going through something very similar in their world ranking systems and how they do strength of schedule and all this stuff. And it kind of brought up some interesting ideas. First one being how circular the rating system is and how essentially if you have something that is inaccurate or not set up in a way to really showcase what your rating actually is, it then affects other people's ratings, which then can affect other people. And then you just have this big circle.
Yeah.
Right. So let me explain that real quick. Essentially, if you play a tournament and the ratings are inflated based off of lower rated players making the course look much harder than it actually is. And you are playing in these tournaments all the time. So now your rating is inflated. Then you go to another tournament to where now you have a higher rating. Now you're going to impact those ratings in a negative way, essentially, right? Because, or you might even impact them. Actually, you might impact them in a positive way, right?
Yeah, it depends on how you play.
Depends on how you play. But you can see how, like, if you have an inflated rating, how then you can inflate or deflate other people's ratings, who then can inflate or deflate other people's ratings. And it makes it a situation where if we're talking about strength of schedule or strength of the field, this was another point that I thought was interesting, is in golf, they were basically saying, and I actually would believe them in this, winning a tournament where you have, let's say, 70 guys, and out of those 70 guys, you only have a handful of the top guys there, winning that tournament is probably easier than winning a tournament where none of the top guys are there, but you have like 140 people. Because in golf, the difference between like number 5 and number 10, or number 10 and number 20, or number 20 and number 30, the gap isn't really that massive. Like number 50 in the world, number 70 in the world can win these tournaments.
Yeah, I guess it's because there is that many more people that could win.
Correct.
Going in, even when the full field's full.
Yes. But in disc golf, you look at something like New World, which had a whole lot of people. There are people in that tournament that just can't win it.
Correct. So I could have showed up to New World and I would have had no chance of ever sniffing the win. Whereas, you're not going to show up to a PGA event. Technically, you aren't going to be on tour in the PGA and have literally no chance at a win, right?
So the guy that won the RSM, for example, that was his first top 5 finish ever, and he just won. So his first top 5 that he ever got, he just wins, right? That's more rare, I would say, in disc golf.
I don't know if it's true backed by stats, but.
For like elite series events?
I mean, it's headed that way, for sure.
Like, who won this year that year is like they've never won before?
Isaac Robinson, but I don't know what, I mean, he's been.
Yeah, but he was also rookie of the year. He was also rookie of the year.
Yeah. He's rookie of the year this year. But he's in contention a lot more, yeah.
No, but my point being is like he's not going to be a flash in the pan. He's going to be a top player for years to come. I'm talking about someone like that has been touring for like 20 years and or not 20, sorry, has been touring for like 5 years, has never had a top 5 and then just wins. Like that seems like it'd be very rare.
Yeah, I can't think of anyone that would fit. I don't really know what the point is, but yes, you're right.
I guess my point is like disc golf right now, just with where it is right now, there seems to be more of a, this is like, these are the top players. These are the middle guys.
Yeah, there's a bigger gap between each category.
And like there's bottom guys where you're like, none of these people have a shot to win or get in the top 10.
Yes.
And there's like a middle section where you're like, none of these people have a shot of winning. And it's like, so when you're doing strength of field, what are they basing strength of field off of? Because you could be a 10-20 rated player. Because if they're doing it off of ratings, you can be a 10-20 rated player and have no chance of winning.
Correct. I don't know what they're doing it off of. I would assume it's ratings, but I mean, they could be doing world rankings possibly. But even
what
world rankings, you could do.
What should they do it off of?
They should do it off of world rankings, in my opinion. But I mean, just because world rankings at least is, I don't know. I'm going to see like in disc golf.
Because in disc golf, in disc golf, if you don't have, if you're one of the top 10 players in the world and you're there and the other nine of the top 10 players aren't there, but 11 through 20 are there, you have a really good shot at winning that.
That is, yeah, that's correct. Yeah. Like if Ricky showed up to a tournament, the number one in the world, and the field was full of, well, let's go AB, Chris Clemens, James Conrad, Kevin Jones, Alden Harris, and Bradley Williams. I can actually just do this with U-Disc's compare thing. So that's 15 to 20th. And then Ricky, if you hit, that's max of six players. Okay. We're going to take Bradley Williams out of the equation. 15 to 19 and then Ricky.
Ooh, Bradley Williams beat him at Preserve.
So if you go Ricky and then the rest of the fields, AB, Chris Clemens, James Conrad, Kevin Jones, Alden Harris, so 15 to 19, Ricky has a 53% chance of winning.
Oh, it gives you just a percentage chance of winning. That's
yeah, win probability. So he has a very solid chance versus you just throw, you replace Alden Harris,
one of those guys
with
one of the
Paul
top.
McBeth, and you hit compare. Now Ricky has 40% chance and Paul has 37% chance.
Hmm.
So it takes his win percentage down by like 14%, just adding one of the top guys in.
I don't even really know what my point 20. Is. I don't even really know what my point is of all
that's
this.
That's what I was saying. I don't really know the point of what you're saying, but what you're saying is true.
I'm saying a lot.
Yeah.
But am I saying anything at all? I don't know.
That's debate night.
Yeah, it's a numbers game, folks. You just say a bunch of stuff and hopefully something sticks. I think what I'm saying is in golf, strength of field.
The amount of players in golf matters for strength of field more than in disc golf. The quality of players in disc golf matters more versus, like, you could have a 20 player field in disc golf, but it's players 1 through 20. It's going to be harder to win that than an 80 player field that only one of the top 20s in.
Yeah.
Whereas in golf, that's not true.
I think if I'm one of the top golfers, I would rather play a tournament. Because again, in disc golf, I guess this was my point. In disc golf, if you're one of the top guys, you're really just looking at a handful of guys and being like, I have to beat these people.
Yeah.
In golf, yeah, you're looking at those people being like, yeah, those people are really good, but I also have to beat these other 80 people that are all in the field.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if there was really a point in saying all that, but I think strength of field is something that I hope that we continue to, I guess this was the point. I hope strength of field is a metric that we continue to tinker with and work with, because I think it is for the people listening to this podcast, like the diehard disc golf fans. I think it is something that is important to look at when you're seeing who's won what. Versus, oh, they just won this tournament. That's a huge win. Like,
yeah,
I think it's interesting to go and look at those numbers, because again, like I wish we had statistics that were really, really solid and locked in of where you could say like strokes gained, because again, I think strokes gained is very arbitrary to the tournaments you play in. Because if you play in a tournament that has a bunch of, for example, like I played absolutely butt cheeks at New World, but my guess is my strokes gained, which I think they're still doing.
They should be.
My guess would be my strokes gained at New World was probably pretty high, because there were a lot of people in the field that weren't that good. And so it made my strokes gained seem probably better than they actually were. Let's see here. Let's see if my theory is right.
Your strokes, like gain tee to green?
Wait, I don't see it.
Gain tee to green, you had 10.04 at New World.
Wait, do you see it?
Yeah, I just read it to you.
Where are you on?
U-Disc?
I'm on my 2023 Disc Golf Pro Tour statistics.
Oh, I'm
see
on
strokes
the New
gained.
World. It's gain tee to
green. Oh, I have to go probably to New World.
Yeah, there's like gain tee to green, gained putting. So you gained 5.6 strokes putting and 10 strokes tee to green.
Yeah, and I played terrible. So let's go to a tournament that I played decent at, D-Glo. Gain D-Glo, putting.
1.9.
Yeah, look at that. Look at that.
Gain
about putting,
the same
negative.
Tee to green
was 1.59.
At D-Glo?
Yes.
Tee to greens, 10.4. Gained putting's 1.9.
Wait, what? Look. Are you?
What? I'm on you.
Are you on this? Are you on this right here?
Yeah, this is this year. You're on this year or you're on last year?
Oh, I'm on 2021.
Okay, that
heck?
Makes sense. Okay, well, 2022 you did much better.
Hold
about
on.
The same
yeah.
strokes gained tee to green, but the putting was drastically different.
Putting was worse or better?
Than New World, worse.
Who cares? Tee to green's perfect. Tee to green strokes gained for both were the same, right?
Tee to green, you actually had more tee to green gained at D-Glo, the New World.
Well, I would hope so because, like I said, New World, I did not play well at all. But the fact that I gained just as many strokes at New World as I did to D-Glo, that shows more about how the – because strokes gained is off of the field.
Correct.
It's so
what you
have,
gained on the average player in the field, tee to green.
Correct. And the average player in the field at D-Glo was much higher than the average player at
correct.
New World.
Yeah, D-Glo so was one I of could the play, more stacked fields.
Yeah, so I could play really bad at New World, but my tee to green is still really good based off of that.
Oh,
so that,
they do have the strokes gained totals down here, 11.3 at D-Glo and New World. Let me scroll down. New World was 10.6. So basically almost the same, half a stroke difference.
Yeah, and I threw way better at D-Glo than I did at New World. So
yeah. Stats are fun.
Wrap it up. Strength of field, very interesting. Something that definitely would like more people talking about that at certain
for sure.
tournaments coming up. Because I think
right.
that would be a good way of seeing like what are some really hard wins out there on tour.
Yeah. All right. There you have it. That's this week's debate night. Hopefully you enjoyed. We'll be back here again, same time, same place next week. Don't forget to check out Black Friday sales, foundationdisc.com. Got a whole bunch going down.
We should do the caller show next.
Caller show next? Okay.
We'll figure if we can make that work.
We might have to go one
that,
more week just because it's Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
Thanksgiving
what the heck?
This week. So we might have to go next week. We'll do the call. Maybe we'll have one more episode, then we'll do the caller show to end out the month and release it at the beginning of December.
We also might be in the Dominican Republic, so that could be fascinating.
That could be okay. Well, there you go. Regardless,
tropical, folks.
We'll have a show next week. We'll talk to you all then.